When I first started meditating, it wasn't because I wanted to discover the nature of love and how it applies to the universe. I just wanted to not feel so shitty. I just wanted to not be so sad that I don't get to talk to my dad anymore. In addressing that, I was given a method that really, really helped. And, you know, a lot of the corporate mindfulness stuff is really geared towards attention, focus, doing your job well. And I love that because as an anthropologist, the first thing I want to do is find out what's important to this person or these group of people, where they are right now. The part of then seeing the through line is what's a method that would help these people get to their goal, but really gets to the root cause of it.
Welcome to the Work for Humans podcast. This is Dart Lindsley. As a child, Bill Duane sought safety through being clever. If he could just figure out how everything worked, he could find stability. And that took him a long way professionally. He was leading technical teams at Google and getting promotions, but then his father became ill and eventually passed away, and Bill found himself out of his depth. As he worked to come to terms with his grief, Bill realized that what he needed was not more safety, it was more meaning. He went on a journey of self-reflection through mindfulness, weaving together diverse spiritual and technical disciplines to arrive at what he does today. Bill now helps individuals and organizations create more meaning in their work and be more innovative by teaching them that caring is fundamental to intelligence. Or to put it another way, love is smart. Bill is the principal at Bill Duane & Associates, a consulting firm focused on innovation. With 12 years of experience at Google and a decade in consulting, Bill specializes in navigating change and complexity across industries like tech, healthcare, finance, and media. Notable clients include Google, Amazon, and the White House, among others. In this episode, Bill and I discuss blending complex disciplines to foster innovation, the interplay between technology and humanity, and strategies for shifting a company's standard thinking. We also talk about spaces where limitless growth is actually ineffective. Optimizing work for the medium and short term, how to use love and care to problem solve, and other topics. All right, to continue supporting Work for Humans, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And now I present my conversation with Bill Duane. Bill Duane, welcome to Work for Humans.
Thank you.
I'm going to say that what's so interesting about reading your work, there's a lot of things that are interesting, but one really interesting thing about your work is how often you are working with co-authors from completely different disciplines. And in fact, you'll have a Tibetan monk or a physicist or a geneticist, all these different kinds of people. And you move in circles that are combining incredibly diverse intellectual topics to find new terrain and then to apply them to human productivity in many cases. So I want to start by just, first of all, asking, how do you describe what you do today? And then I'm going to ask you, how did you get there?
Oh, Lord. So it's a really hard question. When it could be so much, I think it's really important to be able to articulate what you do. So the way I put it now is that I help individuals and organizations deal with innovation challenges in a way that's compassionate and effective. That's the flag I'm flying now. And as you mentioned, I'm thinking ahead to see if I'm about to paint myself in a corner with this metaphor, but let's go for it. So this is the flag I'm flying now. I have flown other flags. I have flown technological product engineering. I have flown the flag of well-being, and now I'm flying the flag of innovation. And the population under that flag are very many different kinds of people. And I think this is a reflection of who I am as a very curious person. And then also what I have fairly late in life realized is my superpower, which had to be told to me by my dear friend, Marianne, we're working on a project together. And she said, you have no idea of your superpower, do you? I said, what? She said, you can look at a very complicated landscape and see a through line and then help other people see it and then use that to get stuff done. I had no idea. She told me maybe like 6 years ago.
That's exactly the experience I had looking at your work. An incredibly complicated landscape that you were drawing together with a through line. And sometimes the through line was innovation. And sometimes the through line was ethical AI. So different through lines, but very, very diverse concepts. And so in order for us to get our arms around that, can you describe how you got to here and your intellectual and I'd say spiritual history?
Yeah. So I've always been a really curious kid and a teacher. My mom tells a story of me showing my sister Brenda how to open up childproof medicine cabinets or, you know, medicine bottles. And the story is told that my parents got separated at the emergency room on my third visit to the emergency room as a toddler with injuries to see if I was being abused. And while they were interviewing my parents, I figured out how to work the latch in the crib in the emergency room. And I knew how to unlock the crib, but I didn't know how to climb down. So I just sort of rolled off, which is where the ER visits came from. And I had a rotator cuff surgery a few years ago. And I wake up, you know, it's full anesthesia. I wake up in the post-op room and all the nurses are smiling and laughing at me. And I'm like, oh no, what did I do? And they said, you're the most curious person we've ever met. You would wake up, asked what every piece of gear did and how it worked, fall back asleep, wake up, and then do it again. So I think that's a huge part. And the curiosity has always been in service of figuring it out. I had some challenges growing up where stability and figuring things out was safe. It made things safer. So on the one hand, there was this intrinsic motivation just to figure stuff out for the sheer joy of it. Two is this belief that if I'm clever enough, I'll be safe. I'll be okay. And so that led a certain compulsive edge to it. And so fast forward in college, I ended up studying anthropology and sociology and public policy, and then doing some social anthropology work through the Project on Human Development in Chicago Neighborhoods. When that project ended, I was using my skills to their fullest at The Gap, Broadway in Chicago, and just socially, just a woman, Renee, who was dating a guy whose younger sister was in charge of admins at an IT consulting firm, mentioned she spent the day interviewing. And I asked a very specific question about the nature of the job. I said, do they have healthcare? And she said, yes. I figured I'd do that while I looked for a real job. So I was an administrative assistant at an IT consulting firm and became buddies with my lifelong friend, Augie, who after a few months of going out to punk rock shows and bars said, hey, I need to hire a system administrator. I can't be bothered to interview anybody. You should come in and do it. So this company went from 700 people to 10,000 as an IT consulting firm and later on became the first web consulting firm. It was originally called Whitman Hart, then March 1st. So I found myself as an engineer and then an engineering manager. And then they went out of business during the first dot-com bust, worked for a few startups then. Then Google called in 2005 about being a technical program manager. And I thought, oh, I'm not who you hire. I'm not from an elite engineering institution with degrees, liberal arts, self-taught. Evidently, not caring and holding it lightly was the right way to do it because I got offered a job and then got promoted a number of times. So I think there was this idea of orienting towards what's needed and what's interesting at this point. And then there's a really big inflection point here, as I suppose I'd been at Google about 4 years and had been promoted to manager during Google's hypergrowth period. And it was really crazy. And around that time, my dad, who I was extremely close to, began his process of his final illness and death, which took a while and was unpleasant. After that, I really ran into a problem. In addition to curiosity, I mentioned there was the shadow of the curiosity. And I would say that at this point, a large part of my engine, my motivational engine, was fear and shame. Wanting to not screw up, especially in an environment with so many amazing people like Google, who were so vastly outclassed me intellectually and for different kinds of intellectual stuff. And I went to a lecture on the neuroscience of emotion that said, My internal state wasn't mysterious or witchcraft. It was a biological system. And this insight was, one is it's actionable. It's like, how do things work? Two is it made this whole world of, we'll call it the spirit, safe for me. That emotions, feelings, intuition could be understood to a certain extent using the tool set that I really, really loved. So this then brought me to Search Inside Yourself and mindfulness-based stress reduction. And then he got very curious about this corporate secular mindfulness that was so valuable to me. I'm like, what's the source code? Which then led me to investigate this Buddhism stuff. And then as an atheist, as someone, as a scientist, as a rationalist, very annoyingly, I found a religion that really worked for me and did 5 years of Buddhist teacher training.
And then you, after doing that, you came back and started consulting two organizations.
Well, there was an intermediate step. So at this point, I was on the executive track in engineering. And after my dad died, I knew that I was working on the time on Gmail production engine, Gmail docs, calendar, spreadsheets, all that stuff. I just knew that having witnessed my dad's passing, that when that moment comes for me in my life, do I want to look back and say, I gave this gift that was given to me of growth, awareness, in service of doing important things? Or do I want to bring Gmail's reliability from 3 nines to 4 nines? Now, I'm not denigrating that activity at all. That is the work of a lifetime and helps so many people. And I knew it wasn't for me. So then I began thinking, like, how do I leverage the good luck, privilege, hard work that I've done? And then I decided to actually take some of these ideas, and I moved from engineering to HR to look after the well-being programs in the learning stuff. And basically is, how do we inculcate a culture of sustainable high performance? So I did that for 5 years. Then after that, then I decided after almost 13 years at Google, it was time to leave. And I knew it was time to leave, but I didn't really know what for. And then there was this period of figuring out for a few years how I might serve. What are my goals at age 50? And then what are activities and a portfolio of projects that would support that goal, which then brought me to the consulting work I'm doing now.
I want to go to the right entry point to your work, but there's so many places that I could enter. I am going to enter right at that point between care and innovation. What is that? You've spoken about the loop of care and that it's a relationship between technology and humans, ultimately. So can you describe that? And I think we'll go through and we'll part it out. And then we'll talk about how that informs organizations.
Yeah, exactly. This is a great intersection because it brings all those threads together. I want to mention at the start that what I'm about to describe is the work of a group of people, not me. So this is coming off of work that the Center for the Study of Apparent Selves is doing, which has been funded up until this point by a series of generous grants from the Templeton World Charity Foundation. Their work is amazing.
That group, when I listened to them speak, because I went out and I researched that group, they sound very much like a group that I am a member of, which is that they are people who have had so many conversations with each other that they can speak at a very high level about very gigantic concepts, sort of like tossing around medicine balls. And if you're not from one of the group that's developed that language, it can be hard to listen to. But I understand what they're doing. The biggest difference is also when they get together, they meet in Kathmandu.
Yeah, which doesn't
sound. That's just way cooler.
Yeah, definitely. So the work that we've come up with is the origin point is, what are concepts from Buddhism that are useful and applicable to the development of artificial intelligence? Because these are two worlds that don't seem to have any connection. So I'll start off by giving an example. Basically, we're saying that love is smart. Love is the smart play. So then you want to go down a level and to say, like, okay, well, how is that actionable? And how might that apply to both humans and AI? So the general idea is that every being, whether it be human, animal, machine, has senses. And based on what you sense, there's also some idea of what you care about. Humans have the ability to care empathically. We have the ability to love, whereas other creatures might not. So we're using the word care so that it applies to all sorts of different substrates, all sorts of different kinds of beings. So if you perceive a situation and something ain't right, there's the idea of, okay, I want to fix this. That's our operating definition of care. Again, for humans, this might be emotional. And that the more care you can bring to the situation, the more possibilities open up. As a very specific example, let's say you're late for a doctor appointment. And as a result of trying to optimize for your arrival time, you start slaloming through traffic because you're caught in traffic. And you, Dart, want to optimize your arrival time, which is the state of winning in that situation. But of course, by pursuing this strategy, you're creating the situation that you're entrapped in the first place. So I, me, mine, I'm going to haul ass to get to shave a few minutes off, but I'm actually degrading the entire environment. Now, let's say you expand your sense of care a little bit. You don't say, I'm stuck in traffic. You say, I am traffic. So this then, and this aligns with Buddhism ideas of self, where if you can expand it a little bit, then all of a sudden strategies that would increase the flow rate of traffic become calculable as winning. So more options are opened up. For example, something I'm really trying to get over is I really don't like bullies and selfish people. So if some jerk in a luxury car comes shooting up the side and merges at the last second, I'll put a dent in my car before I allow that person in because I'm righteous and it makes me feel angry and righteous, which is something historically I kind of enjoy. But that's a form of selfish behavior also, because the traffic engineering is clear, is that if people merge smoothly, traffic goes faster. So if I don't think about my own needs to feel righteous, then instead of the flow rate, I let that person in, and actually the flow rate of traffic is increased. So in this way, there's an idea that it opens up more possibilities. And then neurobiologically, if you train yourself to realize maybe that person, like I'm assuming that person's a selfish jerk, maybe they're late for a doctor's appointment. Now, let's bring in the layer of technology and artificial intelligence. It's not crazy to think that in the future, maybe 50% of the cars around you will be self-driving in some way, maybe in the next 10 years or so, or at least a significant percentage. What if their programming is optimized for the flow rate of traffic? And of course, if you've been in a self-driving car, you're not really just paying attention to the driving. You, of course, the way you, as someone cutting you off and not cutting you off, you just look at your phone and have a conversation and just sort of it goes ding and you're there. So in this case, we can say that we might have these environments of automated systems that are encouraging that. You know, if you think about traffic is like it's fluid dynamics. If all of the water molecules were super selfish. So this is an example of care. And then maybe after doing this, you realize, you know, one of the ideas I've had that I've talked about with some car companies is maybe there's a little beacon you can put on that says, oh no, I'm late. And maybe next to that beacon of please help me is what percentage of the time do you have that beacon activated? So in this case, we can actually then use the technology to increase our care, right? When somebody is the other and there's something about being in a car, we just assume the worst of the other person. So this might be a way in which AI could, both in terms of our perception, as well as just having these automated systems that tilt the physics in favor of a broader sense of self, right? And so I think one of the things that will really determine if AI works out well or not, or humanity works out well or not, is that can we expand our sense of us in a way that doesn't tip over our ability to calculate? Humans get I, me, mine when we're stressed out because it's easier and safer for our neurobiology to calculate that way. So basically, it's a very technical way of saying in the chessboard of reality, love is always the smart play.
And in fact, in the loop, there's the stress, which is being late in traffic. There's the level of care, which is, am I going to care about me as a participant, as an actor, or am I going to care about we? Expand myself to recognize that I am traffic and I am part of the thing. I'm not in it, I'm of it. And then there's a step of intelligence. What is that step? You may have said it. It wasn't called out to me, so I didn't pick it up.
So the intelligence is realizing that there are different and better ways to traverse the problem space. And then that then reveals, there might be then some training that then reveals another layer to be traversed. So in other words, you might want to say, oh, I am traffic. Therefore, I want to work on flow rates. And then that then leads to, oh my God, everyone else in their car is a fully developed human with a backstory and frailties and strengths just like mine. And once you then begin that level of training, what's the next layer that comes off of that? So maybe one thing I'll point out is a problem I had with the model initially that I just unpacked for you is I said, well, is care always benevolent? Like the Bodhisattva vow, which is the Buddhist work that this is based off of, the idea that you develop this ability to perceive with the eyes and cognition of love, and then you use that for the benefit of all beings that are numberless. And so I thought, well, could you say like beings are numberless, instead of saying I vow to free them all, to say I vow to subjugate them all, for I am Zorg, God Emperor of the universe. And I said, so could greed, hatred, and delusion, essentially is that care? And what the director of the center, Thomas, we had a number of very long arguments, where he eventually convinced me, is that if care is less than or equal to the amount of suffering, the system will eventually collapse in on itself. Literally, the only way to sustainably, generatively grow a system is that if care is equal to or greater than the amount of suffering. And I think that's right. That way it allows for this model to acknowledge that selfishness, greed, hatred, and delusion are real and causal. And therefore, it's really concomitant to say in any given situation, like, you know, I'm throwing the L word around a lot, like, what does love mean in this situation? A lot of times love requires good boundaries also.
You know, one of the things you said about states of mind being biological, it's an interesting one because, first of all, I recently realized that anxiety is not a bug, it's a feature.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's something we developed so that we can maintain our membership in the tribe in many cases. And love is also a feature, right? And it's also something that we have because it's important. And I was just talking to somebody who was teaches a course at IDEO on system design. And what she was saying is that you need to zoom in and then you need to zoom out. And that every place in the design process, you need to do both. You need to zoom into the atom, and then you need to zoom back out and look at it in a bigger way. And that actually, you do need to do both, because ultimately, where you design is going to be down at the specific, but you need to design in the context of a larger system. And that's exactly what you were describing in the traffic example, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that issue of scale is really important. The metaphor that was used, I think, in I Am a Strange Loop by Hofstadter says that if you wanted to tell the story of World War II, if you enumerated the daily diary of each soldier, you wouldn't be able to understand at a level that's maybe useful for the purpose of history, of looking at this. However, that would be extraordinarily useful for other contexts. So right now, you and I are operating at sort of the human Newtonian level. However, we are compound intelligences made up of billions of micro-intelligences all pursuing some sort of homeostatic loop of which we experience as stress and connection. And of course, that, going back a little bit further, is, you know, we're also existing at particles at the quantum layer, which has an utterly different set of rules. So the rules at the human layer and the Newtonian layer aren't applicable at a different scale. So I think what your friend at IDEO is pointing to is that you have to be aware that there's different contexts and different scales with different levels of causality even, and therefore you have to be very thoughtful about what scale you're addressing it at, because some of them are more effective than others. Mike Levin, one of my colleagues, does all these crazy experiments where you can rearrange the eyes on a tadpole, and without giving them any specific instructions, they find their way back to where they're supposed to be. So if you were to try and do that by saying, I'm going to control each neuron and make it fire the way it needs to be, you would never get there, right? But if you can understand in code, we say like there's an API, there's some level at which it's easier to solve certain problems than others. So I think this issue of scale is massive. And one of the nice things about science and Buddhism both in particular is they have a real understanding of this notion of scale. And I think as a scientist, as a rationalist, just the idea that quantum physics and Newtonian physics are talking about the same matter, but when you look at it from a different viewpoint, utterly different. So, you know, one thing I'll put about all this care, love, and intelligence is that there's an obvious moral implication to it. But I think what I'm bringing to it in particular is this is smart. This literally opens up new possibilities for solving problems. And I think addresses the core shadow of all of the awesome stuff that's happened in technology to date, which is technology has a tendency to say, we're only going to measure the impact in a very small radius and then declare everything else an externality. This is what Marc Andreessen's Techno-Optimist Manifesto is arguing for, saying that the benefits of technology are so strong that to impede that is immoral. But I think with global climate change, the rise of fascism, a lot of these systems are destabilizing because, you know, we've been throwing our garbage in the basement. The basement's full up now. The externalities are becoming internalities when you're operating at global scale. So when I talk about love, I'm talking about this is useful. This is a functional way of solving problems that our current methods are starting to fail at solving some of these problems.
It's very interesting. I think it was in 79, Milton Friedman had an editorial in the New York Times saying, the value of capitalism is so great that companies should only pursue profit and should have no greater consciousness. And that's moral. What's funny about that is that those two statements are very similar, which is companies have their own goodness and all the externalities don't matter. Technology has its own goodness and all the externalities don't matter. Let's have some high-tech companies that think both of those things and see what we get. So one of the things I see your thinking and others thinking doing in this area is disrupting the sense of self and doing it in a couple of different ways. And I can see now why it's important. So one way of disrupting self is to say, every cell in your body is intelligent. You're not the only intelligence. And that's what Levin is doing, which is saying, guess what? The tail of a flatworm is intelligent. You train a flatworm, you cut off the tail grows a new flatworm, and it still knows how to do things. It still has learned things.
Well, not only that, it retains the memories of the rest of the planaria, which is crazy.
Right, exactly. These are almost like very, very complicated Zen canon, where they're disrupting assumptions about how to center your analysis in a way. So when you come into a company and you're helping with innovation, what is the standard model of thinking that you run into and how do you disrupt it or augment it? Maybe it's not disrupt.
Right. Well, let me use my own self as an example in the sense of when I first started meditating and being curious about neurobiology, it wasn't because I wanted to discover the nature of love and how it applies to the universe. I just wanted to not feel so shitty. I just wanted to not be so sad that I don't get to talk to my dad anymore. And that sadness and that grief was really manifesting in ways of self-harm. I just wanted to not feel so miserable. And so in addressing that, I was given a method that really, at the surface, really, really helped. And, you know, a lot of the corporate mindfulness stuff is really geared towards, even for people that aren't in crisis, it's like attention, focus, doing your job well. And I love that because as an anthropologist, cultural anthropologist, the first thing I want to do is find out what's important to this person or these group of people, where they are right now, and to really honor and respect that and to meet that need, even if it's a surfacey kind of need. Now, the part of then seeing the through line is what's a method that would help these people get to their goal, but really gets to the root cause of it, and then begin constructing something that operates at the right level. So here's an example is a client of mine uses AI to decode animal language, and they were having trouble getting a technical roadmap going. And then in talking to the organization, I found out that they were such nice people from highly diverse backgrounds that difficult conversations were not taking place. Someone said, we're much better at putting ideas on the table than we are off, highly distributed team. So in this case, I knew that they actually needed to argue and feel comfortable arguing, what's called in the research literature, creative abrasion. Okay, so what's preventing that from happening is on distributed teams, Zoom is really good for transactional stuff. It's really not good for online team building. Is always kind of cringy. You can absolutely do it, but it's challenging. So what we did is the leader is very wise of the distributed team. Every 6 or 8 months, they get together somewhere in the world and they get in person for a week, week and a half. And so the work we did was actually beginning was to talk about what are your deepest values as an individual, just not even thinking about the work, like what's most important to you. And in order to really touch the depth, I brought in a death exercise of realizing most of us operate as though we have an infinite amount of time. Not only do we not have an infinite amount of time, we don't know how much. Given that, prioritization about your values becomes really important. What's most important now? So just even to go through that exercise, and two people had lost their parents recently. So before the exercise, I checked in with them and said, this is what I'm thinking. Does that work for you? They said, yes. And I said, if you change your mind halfway through, just pull on your ear and I'll back off. And this led to a very intense, vulnerable, beautiful sharing of what was most, you know, when you lose a parent, it's very deep places you get to. So on the one hand is, as you can say, this was transactional and that we were creating this sense of safety, vulnerability, trust, which then you can build on with the idea of generative disagreement. And then on top of that, then we can begin talking about the values as what are the operational values of this organization. And then they were then able to get to the point of having the arguments that would then lead to a technical roadmap. So in my bag of tricks, sometimes it's stuff like that. Sometimes it's cognizing complexity. But that idea of how do we expand care to introduce more opportunities and then really tie that to some fairly practical, surfacey driver so that there's the sense of this is useful, this is practical, this is worth it.
What I love about that story is the way you reset the baseline. People get involved in a lot of surface things at work. They get involved in a lot of tensions. Some of them are petty. Some of them are narrowly focused. And by grounding it to mortality, you were able to essentially reset the system and build it up. I'd love to talk to you about the drama at OpenAI. You've referred to yourself as a governance geek, and I think it's a fascinating space. So you wrote an article about the real problem with the drama at OpenAI. And it's a nice intersection, I think, because it's right there between running a company and ethics. So what would you say is the real problem?
So first of all, just to ground how I got curious about governance, as I served on the board of directors for some nonprofits and then was the chairman of the board for a nonprofit teaching mindfulness to vets with PTSD. And so one of the things that was very interesting to me as I began serving on boards is there's a difference between management and governance. If you as a board member try and manage the chief executive, everybody's brutally unhappy. And I've seen this really make mistakes. So it's a different set of levers and a different level of subtlety operating at a different timescale. So that's where this interest came in. I have some specific opinions about for-profit, nonprofit hybrids, having spent a certain amount of my life in both. And then when I was on the board of Search Inside Yourself, we were beginning the process of actually creating a for-profit so we could have the energy and vigor and investment of capital markets to really create the kind of change we want in the world while also keeping the mission of service, that the point of the organization was not to create infinite money for the stakeholders, but rather this sense of vitality, and that a for-profit structure introduces a certain level of vitality. And I think Search Inside Yourself has done a great job of executing that model. So I had some information around that. So the real problem with OpenAI is they had this hybrid model where you have the nonprofit owning the for-profit, essentially. There's a little bit more into that. And the idea is that from a governance perspective, that if the for-profit started doing things that were against the core ethos of generative, wholesome AI, then there would be some sort of governance where that board would then apply the levers that a board does to the CEO to do this. But very clearly, the nonprofit was in charge. So the real problem is I think this is a model that can balance short and long-term, this idea of a narrower sense of we to a broader sense of we that I think is not only morally needed, but functionally necessary to navigate AI. My real problem is that in one situation I was dealing with, I had an issue with founder syndrome, which is where the person who founded it has an unusual amount of authorship and they find it difficult to let go and to delegate to other people. You know, even at a small nonprofit, we took a year and a half to get that figured out to everyone's satisfaction. The real problem with OpenAI is they just pull the trigger so fast without any discussion. And then governance, again, is not management. You don't do it by fiat. You do it by putting feelers out, by checking with people to say, how does this land with you? We're talking about doing a course correction of one kind or another. How would this affect you? Is this something you would support or not? So this is governance. But the main issue is that the board acted very percussively and dramatically without consulting the major stakeholders, which included the employees, which included Microsoft. And in doing that, I don't think they did a good job of being board members. And the part that really deeply upsets me is that this hybrid model is exactly the kind of model that we need to be experimenting with. And now I think that as a result of this, that this hybrid model is going to be viewed as pathological. Whereas I think the failure was in the failure of the board members to be good board members, to know about governance and not the model itself.
It was execution, not structure. It's a very interesting structure, which is you've got a not-for-profit that owns a for-profit. What's fascinating about it is that, to me, that model treats money like a drug, which is a little bit of it is Ritalin. A lot of it is crystal meth. And what they were trying to do, it seems to me, is to sort of be a pharmacy and say, okay, OpenAI, there's going to be caps on the amount of money you can make off of this. Yes, you're going to make money. But if you exceed a certain level of making money, that's going to go someplace else. And so pharmaceutical approach, which is a little bit of uppers is okay. But then what happens is I feel it because I am trying to figure out how to govern a company. And when I see the possibility of making money, it's very much like when I'm dieting and I see a bowl of chocolate M&Ms. And there's this chimpanzee in me that lunges at the bars of my diet.
Right.
It's probably literally a chimpanzee and wants those. And I have to hold myself back. So they're right, right? Money can warp the mission of an organization.
Yeah. You know, there's this real question of how much is enough. And I think a lot of the problem is that whatever the answer is always more. I was introduced to a term called inshittification, which is, I think, Cory Doctorow's, the idea that so many of our systems are being strip mined of value, and it's being so precisely dialed in where it's just barely worth it for everyone to participate, thereby allowing the most amount of money to be funneled up in what sometimes is four or five layers of entities that are owning the entities and owning the entities, all of which need to have ever increasing geometric nonlinear growth in order to be satisfied. And let me interject here. Mark Andreessen's Techno-Optimist Manifesto, I read it and I was like, this is hot garbage. I'm pretty sure he wrote this underneath a pinup poster of Ayn Rand. And so when I have a strong emotional reaction to this, I thought, okay, scientist, prove him right. And I went to prove him right that basically is that technology is such a strong benefit for society. And there's really important ways that he is right. And it's really important to acknowledge that even in places with the least amount of privilege that deal with the most with colonialism and racism, even sub-Saharan Africa is much better than it used to be in terms of poverty, maternal death rates, the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, these systems have the capability of just consuming more and more resources and producing more and more resources. And I think particularly in the venture capitalist world is you always want to have nonlinear growth rates. So the question is what we're seeing right now, particularly around climate change, the result of when unlimited growth rates hit limited resources of one kind or another. In this case, the ability of the biosphere to absorb human-generated climate change. So I think we're now, and you know, you could look at like peak oil, whenever that happens, as being another. Again, this is the idea of the externalities becoming internalities. So there's this real question is, up until now, I think it's been pretty useful for us to say, let's grow as much and as fast as we can. Again, less of a moral thing, more of a functional thing is, are there problem spaces for which this is ceasing to become effective? And where they are, how do we then think about bringing the benefits that growth and development has brought humanity, which are amazing and sizable, and it is a much better time to be a human now in lots of ways than others, but also realizing that some of these systems are starting to self-contain themselves in very surprising ways. Politics, economy, climate, social.
And I got to say that AI is a great test case for all of this. It's so powerful. It has the ability to potentially build itself and to advance itself. It has abilities that we haven't seen before. And so the idea of there being a governance model that puts that in a controlled environment makes a lot of sense. The question is whether something in a controlled environment will be outcompeted by something that is uncontrolled. So for years, I was an architect, a business architect. And one of the things I used to say is, bad architecture can out-replicate good architecture any day because it's fast. So how do we bring concepts like these to the leaders and AI engineers that are making decisions about AI and AI models? It sounds like, first of all, incredible starting place. I think it's incredible that the first time AI sort of leapt off of the lab table and started running around, it happened to do that in a lab that was already thinking about these questions.
Right. To your point, we'll try and tie together everything we've talked about so far in answering this question. So there's the question is that, does a narrower sense of self, which is, I want to make a shit ton of money, will that actually outcompete? So this to me echoes to our conversation about scale. And scale is not only level of organization, but also time. So I would say, to use your example of bad architecture, the lifespan of bad architecture is, I would say, much shorter before it gets consumed by the next thing, whereas stuff that's of higher quality. So for me, the question I would frame to business people is, are you want to optimize for the short term or the long term, or even the medium term? And so the work that I'm doing with my clients that involve large tech companies is basically to say, let's figure out a way to demonstrate that this is the smart play in the medium term. Now, one thing about AI in particular is that the timeframes are going to be radically compressed. This presents both a danger and an opportunity. It's a danger in that humans can only absorb so much change before we freak out. And I think we're already a good deal along this idea of freaking out. So I think one of it is to think about, what's the circle of care? Who are we measuring and who are we not? There's a whole separate discipline about how do we measure what's important. One of the huge challenges for technology right now is that which is important is much harder to measure than dollars or compute power, all these things that are very, very numerable. There's a whole emerging problem space that is much less numerable that if we try and just ignore it because it's hard to count, or these systems will lose their predictive power. So this pain, like when my dad died and I was just so awful and turned around, I think some of our systems are going to run into this when our methods that have been highly predictive in the past cease to become, or for certain problem spaces, they have less predictability. So I think that's combined with, there's also this really wild interest in meaning and purpose. Gen Z and millennials in particular, it's table stakes for them. And that's a huge, huge benefit. Two is, how weird is it that psychedelics, in this age, that there's this interest in psychedelics, which to me is a shorthand about an interest in consciousness. AI also intrinsically brings up issues that technology hasn't, about consciousness, selfhood, there's all that. So this is really all coming together. So if we choose the right scale, both in terms of level of organization and time, and then really look at this model saying that we believe that more selfish, short-term, extractive strategies will collapse. And knowing that the accelerated timeframe of AI means that those collapses may happen sooner rather than later, combined with the fact that what got us here won't get us there, we need to let go of some stuff and have some different ways of problem solving. Again, coming back to the beginning, is I think that love is really good for problem solving in a technical, practical, matter-of-fact way. My goal is to try and bring those two worlds together because, you know, I used to have a sticker on my laptop that said, fuck you, I have charts and graphs to back me up. I was one of the members of the Google skeptics initial email list. I get it. I get the suspicion. I get the feeling that some of this stuff is woo or the absence of safety. My whole goal is to try and create a bridge where people who are really good at the linear, rational, reductionist toolset, which has brought so much good to the world, can realize that there are problem spaces that that's not as good for. And wouldn't it be great to have both?
You just answered one of my closing questions. Well, let me see if I'm going to say my closing questions right now, because we have enough time to ask a couple more questions before the closing question. I did have Fred Reichheld on the show. And Fred Reichheld is the person behind customer loyalty and Net Promoter Score. His whole argument is that companies should love their customers. And what he did, which I thought was so interesting, is he basically looked at companies and said, what should every stakeholder in a business model feel as opposed to know? And what he said was, you should love your customer. Your customer should feel loyalty to you, to your company. And I asked him, should companies love their employees? Should they love them? He thought about it for a second and he said, yes. And so he was somebody who actually brought the word love into a business environment. And it was very catching, although he ultimately felt that it wasn't applied in a way that he agreed with, that the tools that he used to equip it had been misused. So there's always that risk. But he's a Bain consultant. I mean, he's mainstream consulting, so it's not crazy.
Well, I'm curious, what were some of the failure modes where he felt that these methods had been misapplied?
Well, using Net Promoter Score was meant to understand how customers felt and act upon it. But instead, what happened is it became a measure of employees. And everybody became incented because their bonus was tied to their Net Promoter Scores. And all of a sudden, they were put into a situation. I've had this. I went into a store and the person said, look, would you please answer the Net Promoter Score survey? And could it please be a 10 out of 10? Because anything less than that will get punished. That's what this was about. It was about punishment. And so that's the way it happened, which is that the tools that were designed to measure feelings were used inappropriately.
Right. So the way I've heard that class of concern is when metrics become targets. We saw this with CompStat in policing of let's actually look at the metrics, measure them, and then use that to determine how we should be policing, which is great. It sounds fantastic. The problem is that you're expected to show consistent reduction in crime, even though the police don't actually have the ability to eliminate. But month over month, it has to constantly be going down, which is impossible. So this is when metrics become targets. And I think this speaks to the conversation we're having about numerability. Our current methods of scaling are to take very complicated things and reduce them to something that's quite countable, that ideally you can compare across different domains, like Net Promoter Score. So I'd say the failure mode that you were just discussing is something pathological about our relationship. Because when we take something as complicated as love or a human relationship and reduce it to any score, there is a reductionist, is literally reductionist. So if we think about all the layoffs that are happening, you can imagine all these layoffs as a spreadsheet where you want the main cell to turn green, which is that have we lowered the cost of labor sufficiently? And there's a whole bunch of boxes you can fiddle with to make that happen. Well, maybe we should target employees that have been here a long time because they have the tendency to be paid the most, or maybe the people that are highest rank or something. You know, and of course, every time you fiddle with one of these numbers, You hear stories about somebody who got laid off on their second day back from maternity leave, or while they were out on medical leave having cancer care or something. These systems, and again, as I'm not talking shit about them, because these systems are wonderful for scaling. The complexity of our society requires some method of scaling. The question is rather than saying this is good or this is bad, we can say that, well, metrics are really, really useful for scaling. And almost invariably, metrics become targets. What do we do about that? And the reason why they become targets is that the human nervous system gets overloaded. If I asked you to contemplate 300 people's lives today, just random 300 people, everything they did from waking up to going to bed, there's no way you could retain it all. So when we think about AI, one of the things I'm curious about is, could AI learn what is salient to human beings, particularly around issues of care and love? And that can hoover up so much more data that would explode our brains. Again, is we're not doing these spreadsheets because we're bad people. It's because it's a method that works, but has this reductionist shadow. Can we have our cake and eat it too? I'm not sure. But when I talk about coming up with new methods of expanding care, what if instead of a spreadsheet where we just looked at the cost of labor, there was some other thing of like, can you please, you know, one of the shittiest things about being in senior leadership is certain complexity and scale, you're going to hurt people with every decision. The only way to do that is to not make a decision which is harmful. You know, it's so soul destroying to go weeks where all of your decisions are which option is the least bad. And as an executive, if they were easy, they'll be handled by the awesome people that are working for you if it doesn't require like a crappy decision. I would love if I could say, look, we need to make this tough decision for the good of all, but I really, really want to know who's going to get hurt by it so I can take some corrective action. In the Buddhism and AI project, this is a huge one. So I love cats. I want my cat satisfaction metrics to be going up and to the right. So I let my cat outside so it can lead its best cat life. If I'm only looking at cat satisfaction metrics up and to the right, bird and small mammal metrics in my backyard plummeting, right? So imagine then if in deciding if I want to optimize for cat satisfaction, someone said, hey, you know what? This is going to lead to problems for birds and small mammals. And then I could think, maybe I'll put a bell on the cat, right? That's an expansion of, I'm not just thinking about the cat, I'm thinking about all the creatures in the backyard. And then there's some way of mitigating. So we don't need to assume a perfect world. What we need is the ability to, in a way that scales, surface a richer set of conversations. And AI doesn't need to understand love and emotion. It can extrapolate what it expects a human would think of and bring it to our attention. So this is a way in which I think the work I'm doing at Google X is described as human AI hybrid systems of care. And I think this is really crucial because we're talking about Laurie Anderson before. Laurie Anderson paraphrased Bruce Schneier saying, if you think technology will solve all your problems, you don't understand technology and you certainly don't understand your problems. If we fail at AI, it's going to be because we failed as humans. I think that's much more likely than some sort of a technical oops that would lead to Armageddon. Therefore, I think it's absolutely crucial that when we think about building these new scalable systems, we think about human AI hybrid, which means we have to develop the felt lived experience of care and compassion. Otherwise, how could we possibly build systems that have those? And this is why my podcast is called The Heart of Innovation. I think in innovation methodologies, this is the part that's missing. There's the external part and there's the internal part. There's the technology part, and then there's the point of view part. Like in Buddhism, they call it bodhicitta. Enlightenment mind, love mind. It is a way of perceiving and cognizing. Luckily, those are trainable skills.
What is the human AI hybrid system of care that you're talking about? What does that mean?
We're at early stages and just getting started, but the nature of the work is to research and explore what does a combination of training humans and training technology together look like. So basically, all the stuff we talked about is looking at certain problems and challenges and things that Google X is trying to develop and to say, how might this model be of service in making this an amazing product that's highly functional.
A product, is it for healthcare or is it just for anything?
So there's going to be a applied to a number, but in specific, I've been asked to not talk about the specific projects.
Okay. Fantastic.
What I can talk about is that the nature of this relationship is anything that's proprietary that we come up with, Google X gets to keep. It is their intention and it's in our contract that anything that is of benefit to the world eventually gets released that's non-proprietary. So this was really important to me in setting up this work. And something I really honor and appreciate about the folks I'm working with at X is the sincerity of them really wanting to give this a shot. They believe it's true. They want it to be true. And they're willing to put some time and resources into giving it a shot.
That was one of the things that Google did, I think last year, that I was so pleased about. Google essentially solved protein folding. And everybody was like, is Google going to make protein folding a proprietary thing, or are they going to release it? And the answer was all of the algorithms were released and something like 2 million folded protein solutions were released. And so, or 200 million, some enormous number. And so it's very good that that became a public good for drug discovery and other things.
Yeah. So this is an example, I think, of broadening the sense of care, both in terms of scope and also time, because certainly this moves the science forward. And I'm really happy and I'm impressed by the sincerity. And I wasn't sure how often I would use the L word. But as it turns out, I'm starting a new organization with a colleague of mine. And our tagline is operationalizing love. We actually want to have a very disciplined scientific research methodologies that then also has a quick feedback loop with industry, because the pace of AI is going to move so quickly that we really need to look for every opportunity as soon as we can to have this operationalized love in place.
So one of my closing questions is, which I think you've answered, what do you hire your job to do for you?
I want to leave the campground better than I found it. At the most basic, I had a cancer scare a few years back. I'm an anxious person by nature, and I was very surprised at how unanxious I was. I think because I had integrity in the sense of more and more, far from perfect, my actions match my intentions more. And my intentions are getting upgraded little by little, sometimes dragging, kicking, and screaming. And so I think that that sense of integrity, one of my teachers, Shinzen Young, says, if you have that kind of integrity, or at least if you're working on it, you can stride through this world like a colossus. So I think at the highest level, it's just, I want to leave things better than I found them. The way this specifically applies, in particular, this is the reason why I've changed my flag from well-being to innovation. I'm talking to you from three doors off Haight Street in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, which was the epicenter of a really big social movement that became a worldwide movement. And there's this real question. I'm sure during the 60s, when all the civil rights stuff was happening, some people just didn't get involved and just went about their day to day. So there's this real question of, in this moment of time, how can I help? And well-being is really, really important, but the systems around us don't actually value it that much. It's a weak strategic position to make systemic change. And HR, I think, can be. These HR systems changed my life, and I don't want to change lives. I want to change systems on top of that. So they're a necessary but insufficient condition. Innovation, on the other hand, it's the zeitgeist of our time. Systems around us are crumbling. Sometimes this is really good. Racism, sexism. Other times it's bad. Democracy, reality, rationalism, the biosphere. In either condition, we need to invent new ways of doing things. What got us here won't get us there. That means innovation. So I really want to help with innovation at all the layers of coaching and mentoring senior leaders, consulting, workshops, all that stuff. And this is all in service of, we need to up-level how we innovate. And as I mentioned, my assessment of the current landscape of innovation methodologies, they are so focused on product market fit and externalities, which is really important. But I'd say the most common failure modes are more internal in groups. We may have a visionary, but it is a group of people that makes it happen. And it's a group of people buying it or buying into it that makes it happen. And I think those dynamics are underserved. So I want to leave the campground better than I found it. And I want to use the methods of connecting the world of the rational and the world of love in a way that's functional, that the current reality values, such that I'm given the resources to play at the level that will make systemic change.
What does your work cost you?
It's tough for me to feel satisfied sometimes. I think when you work in very, very broad domains, it's really important to make sure that the individual sense of satisfaction. This is why when I was the chairman of the board of the veterans nonprofit, I taught, because my soul gets filled from looking in someone's eyes and knowing that I helped them. And in doing so, I learned something. So it's a little counterintuitive when you're trying to work at big scale, but I always need to teach. I always need to mentor. I always need to coach, because if you're setting your goals beyond the possible, you can have that in Buddhism, what's called a hungry ghost, an entity that's forever hungry, but it has very, very tiny throat, so it can never be satisfied. I want to have that active energy in the world, but we also need to be at a very deep human level, satisfied and content, and knowing it's not stuff that brings you satisfaction and content, although it's a necessary but insufficient condition.
There is very little feedback loop when the objectives you are trying for, the scale of them is longer than a life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very open loop way of working in the world, which is that the outcomes you often strive for are maybe 100 years out. And so it's an interesting challenge. Where can people learn more about you and more about your work? We're going to include a lot of links with this show. And what people will find is that these are links that are from a lot of different authors and all around this topic. But where can people find you most directly?
www.billduane.com, BILLDUANE.com has links to some of the work that I've done, some descriptions of the way that I work with people, and a method of contacting, as well as a link to the Heart of Innovation podcast. So that's all linked off there.
Thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Work for Humans. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts, and share the show with one person you think would get value from it. Believe it or not, this really helps us grow the show and reach more people who want to build the kind of work that people really want. As always, thank you to my producer, Jason Ames at Ninth Path Audio, for his insights into content and his high standard for quality. Final note, the opinions shared here are my own and not the views of Google or Cisco Systems. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.